And seeking the light of God's Spirit on His Word, we turn again to that Old Testament passage that we read together, the book of Nehemiah, and chapter 4, and we'll read again just now at verse 19. Nehemiah chapter 4, reading from verse 19. And I said unto the nobles, and to the rulers, and to the rest of the people, the work is great and large, and we are separated upon the wall, one far from another. In what place therefore ye hear the sound of the trumpet, resort ye thither unto us, our God shall fight for us. So we labored in the work, and half of them held the spears from the rising of the sun till the stars appeared. Likewise at the same time said I unto the people, that every one with his servant lodge within Jerusalem, that in the night they may be a guard to us and labor on the day. So neither I, nor my brethren, nor my servants, nor the men of the guard which followed me, none of us put off our clothes, saving that every one put them off for washing. Now, in the earlier chapters of this book, we see Nehemiah stirred by the Lord, stirred to such an extent that he leaves his own situation as cupbearer to the king and comes all the way to Jerusalem. And having arrived in Jerusalem with a desire in his heart, a mission in his heart, he encountered serious difficulties as he commenced the rebuilding of the city. But with the Lord's help, these difficulties were overcome. But here in the fourth chapter, with the work now underway, Nehemiah discovers that his initial difficulties were being replaced by new problems. There are new and different challenges emerging here in this fourth chapter. In the first few verses, we see Sanballat and Tobiah coming and giving their own opinion on the work that was being undertaken. And they do two things, really. First of all, they ridicule the work, and you see that in verses 2 and 3 there. They ridicule the work. They scoff the people who were engaged in the building. They mock the materials that they were using, and even the Lord Himself is not spared some of their mockery. Now, without going into any of that in any great details, it sounds, doesn't it, very familiar, that same note of ridicule, scoffing and scorn. How often we hear it. The Lord's cause, the Lord's kingdom, the Lord's work, held up for public ridicule by its enemies. But they don't just come with taunts. We see that they also come in significant numbers. Verse 2 speaks of the Sumerian army. And they do that, of course, in order to intimidate the workers there in Jerusalem. And again, we see that. We see that in our own day. And we're seeing more and more of that. The use and the abuse of the law to silence the church and to frustrate the church, whether in the presentation of the gospel or in the upholding of order and morality. The enemies were intent on the total ruination of this work. And behind it all, of course, Satan himself, who was determined to do all that he could so that this rebuilding and all it involved in the present time in which they were building and in the future would come to naught. And isn't that really what the enemies of the gospel still want? The annihilation and the ruination of the kingdom and the work of Christ. If they had their way, there would be no synod, no presbytery, no church session, no act of public worship from one end of this kingdom to the other. But of course, now as then, their word, their plan is not the final word, for there is a God in heaven. Well, we see then in the next section how Nehemiah responds to these difficulties. He responds in prayer, and we see from verse 9 that he was not alone in praying. It says in verse 9, "Nevertheless, we made our prayer unto our God." There were things they couldn't do. They couldn't finally and absolutely remove Sanballat and Tobiah. Neither could they just dismiss the danger and pretend that their threats were meaningless. They weren't. They were real threats. There were some things they couldn't do, but there were other things they could do. And one of the things that they could do was to pray, and pray they did. Now, we don't have time just now to go into that prayer, but they do four or five things in the prayer. They affirm their faith. They share their anxieties. They acknowledge their weakness. They confess their need. And don't we need as a people to do exactly that in the face of the difficulties of the hour? Well, they gather and they pray. Well, we might think that everything would be fine after that. But life isn't like that. And the Christian life is rarely like that. We see in verse 10 that discouragement set in. The initial enthusiasm began to wane. And we know, friends, how quickly that can happen as well, don't we? How quickly after a high point, be it a communion season or something else, and we experience great blessing and we are stirred up to the work and the cause of Christ, and then the enthusiasm begins to wane again, and the fear of the enemy comes in. We see that in the verses there in the middle of the chapter. The people are saying, the strength, verse 10, the strength of the bearers is decayed, and there is much rubbish, and we aren't able to build the wall. And they say later on, we're so vulnerable, we're going to be attacked. If we're not attacked from one direction, we'll be defeated from the other. So it begins to halt the progress again. Now, Nehemiah knew that he couldn't interrupt the work every time he heard a new rumor and every time a new difficulty rears its head. So he set up a defense plan. It involved building and it involved defending. This is, of course, where Mr. Spurgeon got the title of his magazine, "The Sword and the Trowel, a Record of Combat with Sin and Labor for the Lord." And with the passing of the year, it is as applicable and as appropriate tonight as ever it was. The church is to be building by the grace and might of God, by the power of the Spirit, yes, but defending as well. We could speak about the importance of creeds in the Christian church. We could speak about the importance of the church speaking clearly on matters of interest in the public square. Defending and building. And as they worked, Nehemiah encouraged them with the words in verse 20, "Our God shall fight for us." A good text for the morning. A good text for difficult times and the days when the going is hard. what I want to do now is to look at Nehemiah's words and the effect that they had on the people. Notice, first of all, to begin by looking at the words of Nehemiah in that section that we read there. And there are three things I want to bring to your attention. Three things that Nehemiah highlights, which it would be good for us as the people of God and as a synod meeting tonight to bear in our own minds and hearts. First of all, Nehemiah highlights God's sovereignty. He highlights God's sovereignty. It would be very poor comfort indeed if all Nehemiah had to speak of was a God who, if he wasn't weaker than the powers that were against them, at least was no more than their mere equal. If all that he could direct his people to was a God who might be overcome by the enemies, who might be suppressed by the gods and the false idols of the enemies, there was little comfort for them there. But if he could direct them to a sovereign God, who was stronger than Sanballat and Tobiah and the army of Samaria, supposing it was 1,000 times stronger than it was even then he had a message to give them. If it was a God who overruled, who orders his purposes, and whose plan and purpose runs in a straight line without ever having to be diverted. And that's exactly the message that Nehemiah brought to them. A God of sovereign power. A God of sovereign purpose. Oh, he was no mere equal to the powers and the hostilities that they faced. He was a sovereign God. And Nehemiah lived and labored on that premise. That's what took him, first of all, to this city itself. His heart, knowledge, and belief in the God of heaven, who was sovereign. And that's what kept him going, day in and day out. And when he speaks of our God who shall fight for us, he's speaking of one who he knew was a God of sovereign power. You speak about God fighting for us, Nehemiah. What is he like? Oh, says Nehemiah, he is the strongest. Yes, he says, and he is the wisest. He is the governor. And whatever opposition rears its head, it will always be the case that that opposition is infinitely inferior to him. If the most powerful one, if Almighty God, if the sovereign, the only sovereign, is with us, for all will be well. Now we know all about God's sovereignty. This isn't a novel point that I'm making tonight. We know all about God's sovereignty. We could speak on it and we could elaborate on it. But is it not the case that often though we know it, we don't apply it? We don't remember it. We don't live by it. Our members of Synod and Christian friends, as we look in the day in which we live and that part of the land in which we live, and as we see much to discourage and frighten and concern us, let us remember afresh that the Lord reigns. That he is able to turn the hearts of the children of men. that he is able to bring the counsel of Ahithophel to foolishness, that he is able to turn the hardest and the most belligerent voices and bring them like Saul of Tarsus to their knees and into his kingdom of grace. Oh, let us never forget it. Let us pray with this in mind. Let us live and work and witness and preach with this in mind. Let it be in our pulpits and in our pews and in our prayer meetings as we meet for prayer. This great, glorious truth, the sovereignty of our God. Or the answer and the solution may not be immediate. The remedy may not become instantly obvious, but he is sovereign. Remember the way Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego affirmed that in their own difficult circumstance there. They're facing the burning fiery furnace, and they're clinging to this. Daniel 3:17. If it be so, our God whom we serve is able to deliver us from the burning fiery furnace, and he will deliver us out of thine hand, O King. But if not, oh, they were realistic. They knew that it wasn't always deliverance. They knew that sometimes the burning fiery furnace was the lot of the Lord's people. But it wouldn't be the lot of the Lord's people because their God was unable to deliver them. Not a bit of it. No, O King, that our God is sovereign, that he reigns, that he reigns over this kingdom of yours. Nehemiah, as he speaks to the people, he highlights God's sovereignty. But then particularly in these verses, he highlights, secondly, God's loyalty. He highlights God's loyalty. You know what it's like yourselves if you have someone whose loyalty you can depend on. Somebody you know who will stand with you and who will fight with you, come what may. But Nehemiah says, our God shall fight for us. Not only is he God, immortal, invisible, the only wise, but he is our God. And he is our God because he has chosen us for himself. It wasn't a case that they made him their God. It was the reverse of that, wasn't it? He had made them his people. This setting apart was his work and not their work. Oh, he is loyal, says Nehemiah. Always loyal to his people. Always loyal to his cause. It's a covenant loyalty. And it's a covenant loyalty sealed with blood. We can rest assured tonight, not only of his power, for he is God, but we can rest assured of his loyalty to his own people and to his cause and to his kingdom. He is our God, and he will never cease to be their God. Such loyalty, even at a human level, has the effect of encouraging. Such loyalty, even at the level of at the human level, has the effect of emboldening, doesn't it? You feel better, you feel stronger. Well, friends, it's not at the human level. It's not what he said as he takes them out to Bethany. Lo, I am with you. How long is always? Even unto the end of the world. He highlights God's sovereignty. He is God. He highlights God's loyalty. He is our God. But then thirdly, he highlights God's hostility. His hostility. His hostility to all that is evil. Our God shall fight for us. How different this is to the way in which he is so often portrayed. You know what I mean. It's distasteful and you don't want to go into it, but he is portrayed as benign, in a harmless, weak, accommodating, ineffective way. One who will stand up for nothing. One who bends and changes as readily as the sons of men. But oh no, the God that Nehemiah speaks of is a God of hostility. For he is a God of holiness, a God of righteousness, a God of law and order. And friends, synod, fathers and brethren, Christian friends, we need to bear this with us as well. His sovereignty, yes, it comforts us. His covenant loyalty strengthens us. But it strengthens us for the fight. Because he is a God of hostility, and he calls his people to hostility and to warfare. Or not to belligerence. For the sake of belligerents, not as troublemakers, for the sake of troublemakers, or rebels without a cause, but no. He calls them to stand. To stand for his own standards, for his law, for his day, for his word. In an ideal world, there would be no need to fight, of course. But in this fallen, sinful world, it is necessary. And it is a part of the work of the church. They are not simply to abandon their post and let Sanballat and Tobiah come in and put everything under their feet and under their own way. And that's what happens later on in Nehemiah, isn't it? You remember when he returns to Jerusalem after a time away, what does he find? He finds this man in the city, in a position of influence. And he has to be driven out afresh. Yes, he is loyal to his church. Before even that, we have to remember that he is loyal to himself. And he is loyal to his truth. And if fighting is necessary to preserve these things, if fighting is necessary to guard his church, he will fight. And he calls his people to share in that work. Sanballat and Tobiah persist in their hostility. They will discover the hostility of God. And they will find out what it means. The apostle speaks, doesn't he? As he writes to Timothy. Of having fought the good fight. Oh yes, I know there an internal fight and a struggle with sin and indwelling corruption. But that's not the only fight. But even for the apostle, even that hostility has its sweetness to it. Because ultimately he discovered in it the Lord fighting for his people and bringing them through. He wasn't fighting for them there in Jerusalem because he was the tribal God of the Jews. He was doing it to move forward his own predestinated plan in order to bring gain and life and redemption to sinful men and women through Christ, who would be crucified outside these city walls. Nehemiah highlights God's sovereignty, God's loyalty, and God's hostility, urging them to press on, building and defending. What effect, secondly, do Nehemiah's words have on the people? Well, I want to highlight two things. First of all, it had the effect of uniting them in the work. On hearing that the Lord was behind them, their God, it made it easier for them to come behind one another. And soldiers need to be close together. We see that in several ways in the passage. They're listening to the trumpet. We see that in verse 20. In case of any special need, he said, you know how it is. We're separated on this wall. We're a bit of a distance one from the other. But there is a trumpeter ready to trumpet out a call of special needs. They had an ear for one another's difficulties, a heart for one another's difficulties, a concern for one another's difficulties. Fathers and brethren of Synod, Christian friends, let us learn afresh to bear one another's burdens and to heed the trumpet call when it comes, and to have hearts and ears that are ready for the call of distress. And we must acknowledge that too often we have turned a deaf ear to it because it is not convenient. You can imagine some of these workers on the wall, and they hear the trumpet. Somebody is in distress. Somebody has seen something that alarms them, the army of Samaria coming or whatever. And they're busy, they're preoccupied. Or perhaps they know the person who is sounding the trumpet, and there is some measure of ill will somewhere in their heart. No, says Nehemiah, the trumpet will sound. Bear one another's burdens. It's uniting them in the work. But we see them as well holding their spears. They're listening to the trumpet and they're holding the spear. Verse 21. They're guarding each other. The spear was to guard themselves, of course, but also to guard their neighbor, who weren't looking the other way. They were ready to guard. Each one leaning on the other, and all of them leaning on the Lord, of course. It had the effect of uniting them in love. This is something we need to call ourselves back to again and again, isn't it? to be united in the work of the gospel. Sometimes crisis comes, and that has the effect of uniting. And we can remember back, 15 years ago, 14 years ago, the way it did unite, and we bore one another's burdens. But you know, the passage of time and easier days come, and these things can fall by the wayside, not so much by intent as just by the passage of time. Well, let's renew, as it were, our commitment one to another within the bounds of synod in our differing congregations. It is the effect of uniting them in the work, but I think it had a second effect as well. It had the effect of making them ready for self-sacrifice. I think there are three ways in which this is demonstrated. First of all, we see that they were at the work all day. Verse 21. From morning till evening, the despondency of verse 10, if it hasn't altogether gone away, at least it's now overshadowed by this renewed vigor. They hear Nehemiah speaking of God's sovereignty, loyalty, hostility, and they are ready to give of themselves. They are ready to give every available moment for this great work. How often our time is stolen. Is it not one of our great sins? They were aware that they were building up the wall, and at least those of them who were spiritually discerning people were aware that they were building up the wall, not just so that the wall would look good, but that they were concerned with serious issues of life and death and the kingdom of Christ against the kingdom of darkness. And they heard Nehemiah, and they were encouraged to self-sacrifice. We wrestle not against flesh and blood, against principalities and powers, spiritual wickedness in high places. Following the Lord involves self-sacrifice and costly living in different ways in our lives. There's a taking up of the cross. They were at it all day. They were ready for self-sacrifice. But then we see as well that they came from the other towns and they stayed in Jerusalem at night. I think it's verse 22 there. Likewise, at the same time, said I to the people, let everyone with his servant lodge within Jerusalem, that in the night they may be a guard to us and labor on the day. Some of them were going out after the end of the day and going to the surrounding areas again. Nehemiah is encouraging them to stay together to help guard the city. Oh, that can't have been easy. That involved great self-sacrifice. With their hearts in it, that too became possible. Ah, let us use our time well, use our time wisely, and let us come together as often as we can in order to guard and help one another. And one of the very practical ways in which we can do this, of course, is communion seasons. What a blessing that we still have them in our midst. Well, let us make use of that means of grace, these ordinances, as a way of helping and strengthening one another. Let everyone with a servant lodge within Jerusalem, that they may be a guard to us and labor on the day. Maybe that's one way in which we can express afresh our readiness for self-sacrifice. their self-sacrifice. They were engaged in it, and in all the available hours. They were careful with their use of time. They were coming from the other towns and staying in Jerusalem. And thirdly, we see that indeed none of them put off their clothes. Verse 23, they slept in their clothes. They were ready for the surprise attack. They were ready for the surprise attack. They were on the watch. Let's be ready and on the watch. Because the enemy, how often when men sleep, he sows tares. The effect Nehemiah's words had on them, it had the effect of uniting them in the work. And it had the effect of making them ready for sacrifice and self-sacrifice. Well, friends, may Nehemiah's words stir up within us something of that response. We rest on thee, said the old writer, our shield and our defender. We go not forth alone against the foe. Stay in thy strength, safe in thy tender keeping. We rest on thee, and in thy name we go. We go in faith, our own great weakness failing and needing more each day thy grace to know. Yet from our hearts the song of triumph pealing, we rest on thee, and in thy name we go. And one day, the Lord will give his faithful soldiers a crown of righteousness that fadeth not away. We know how it ends, this mission and work of Nehemiah. We know that the Lord crowned it with blessing, and that he turned what seemed impossible into reality. They trusted in that sovereign, loyal God, and blessing came not because of their sustained exertion, but in and through their sustained work because of God's strength and loyalty and grace. For except the Lord build the house, they labor in vain that build it. The work is great and large. We are separated upon the wall one from the other, and we are within our differing localities and synods. And we live in a day anyway when life is so separate and compartmentalized that even if we live in the same village, the same town, we are in a way separate one from the other. In what place therefore ye hear the sound of the trumpet, resort thither unto us. Our God shall fight for us. Well, may the Lord bless his own word. We'll unite in prayer.